Support for WPR comes from Lawrence University in Appleton, a national liberal arts college and conservatory, offering an engaging global education with funding for internships, research, study abroad, and more. Lawrence.edu.
Support for WPR comes from Isthmus Partners, an asset management firm providing comprehensive financial planning and tailored investment solutions for long-term growth and capital preservation. More at IsthmusPartnersLLC.com.
Well, we're closing in on the end of another year. How'd that happen? Where did it go? A lot of us are taking stock, maybe you are, of how it went for you. And certainly entomologist Phil Pelletieri, no different. He's taking a little stock, too. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network. As we talk with Phil, he's a UW Extension entomologist and in charge of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. We're going to talk about the insects that had a good year and the ones that maybe were present in lower numbers than usual. And he's also going to share his bug of the year. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234, and I hope you will. Phil, great to have you back.
Nice to be here.
You always have a bug of the year.
Well, this is the time of the year you got to get your annual reports in. And so I kind of look at, just the way the season went. And the interesting thing to me is, last year I had set a record with number of samples processed and emails and whatnot. And that made a lot of sense because we had such a long growing season, all these southern migrants. This year, as I'm starting to wind things up, I have exceeded the numbers of specimens. Emails down maybe a little bit. And it didn't seem that buggy. I mean, I always have something to talk about. That's
sure.
Not the problem. But it really didn't seem overwhelming to me. And so I'm a little perplexed. You kind of look through. And my colleagues will tease me on this one, but my bug of the year is not a bug. It's a tick.
Ah.
And it's the Lone Star tick. And to me, it's got two interesting aspects to it. Now, historically, I have occasionally found one of these, and we figured one was hiking up on a bird. But it's kind of a Missouri tick, southern Illinois, Missouri. My colleague Susan Paskowitz and her students work a lot with ticks, and there's very strong evidence they're breeding in the state now. And this is something we've talked about so often on the show, that the lack of really cold, and I mean 30 below type temperatures, are allowing many things to move upwards. And this is another classic example of that. The governor moved us to Missouri and didn't tell us. This is what I always usually state. But so having that presence, very interesting. It's also interesting. Recent reports have shown that some people develop meat allergies after they've been bit by one of these ticks. Not everybody, but a very interesting reaction.
Meat allergy.
Meat to red meat.
Boy.
Apparently, the antibodies that are produced in reaction to the tick bite then react to red meat. The other part of this, though, is the Lyme disease story. And about 4 or 5 months ago, the CDC came out and basically told us that the reports that we have of annual occurrence of Lyme disease in all our states is only 10% of what's going on. So instead of 3,000 cases, that means we're experiencing 30,000 cases.
Wow.
So there's a lot going on with ticks. So it seemed kind of a natural to me when I really sat back and thought about it, is to use that as my bug of the year.
Are you concerned about how big a concern is it to have this Lone Star tick now in the state?
Well, it is capable of transmitting a couple other diseases. To me, again, it's more of a teachable moment because...
Yeah.
Lyme disease now, we have four other organisms associated with, and apparently a fifth one that's not even described yet, which is up in the Eau Claire area. And again, Dr. Paskowitz and some of her colleagues are working with that. So there's a lot going on with ticks, and it's something, it won't go away. So I think we all have to, if you're an outdoor person, you have to take precautions.
Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, our guest today. Rebecca in Greenfield has a question for you. And... for some reason, I'm not able to get Rebecca on. Huh. Well, that's interesting. We'll see what we can do about that. I think there's a little problem with my turner on her here. So we'll see. Maybe it's not turned on. We'll see what we can do here. Rebecca from Greenfield, hold on. We'll see what we can do here. We've got some more callers coming in. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk was on to talk with us about pet health yesterday, and I know she shared an article with about how pets are also affected by bed bug problems, and we need to think about their bedding as well, do we not? The toys and even the clothes?
Well, in particular, the bedding. And it turns out that the human bedbug is, under certain circumstances, will feed on pets. There's no evidence that they can sustain a population and breed off them. In fact, my colleague down at University of Florida tells us that when they tried to raise bedbugs on rats, the rats died, but the bedbugs didn't sustain themselves. Because most bedbugs are bird feeders, we do know that human bedbug could survive on chickens. So that's the one exception. If you have chickens for a pet, then aside from just causing biting reactions. But I guess what we have to keep in mind then is that if a house has a moderate bedbug infestation, that the bedding of the dog has to be taken care of, or the cat, because that is a prime place they could be. Bedbugs don't stay on hosts like ticks and fleas and the like. So it's more the places where animals rest. And again, the biting will cause, potentially, I think, some localized reactions, nothing worse than that. But you can't ignore that, just like you worry about beds, bed frames, couches, other plush things. Animal bedding is another place that should be laundered, put under high heat, those kind of things to help protect it.
I wonder, this kind of weather, if you could just take the bedding and...
With this kind of weather, I wonder if you could just take the bedding and toss it outside for a few hours.
Not cold enough.
Not cold enough.
In fact, again, I just read another repeat study of things that we have seen before about the thermal death point of bed bugs is somewhere around minus 15 degrees. So if you've got minus 15 degrees, you're okay. At 0 degrees, it probably will take a day or more to kill them. And above zero, it's even less. And so that the problem is when we think about the coldest temperature, it doesn't sustain itself long enough. And again, right now we're experiencing Madison 5 below, and it just isn't quite there.
So even the freezer...
Well, the freezer, it depends if you can leave it 3 or 4 days. Most freezers are around zero. Yeah. So that's what you have to keep in mind. And, it's putting something in a refrigerator, it'll stay alive for months. As I said, it's 32 is not the point. With bed bugs, it's somewhere around minus 12 to minus 16 degrees Fahrenheit.
Well, I think we have our phone issue solved. So let's go to Rebecca in Greenfield. Hi, thank you very much for calling.
Hi, it's so nice to talk to you. Can you hear me?
Yeah, yes. Just begin to speak up a little bit if you can.
Okay. Well, my question for Mr. Pelletieri is about ants in the summer. I've noticed that sometimes they'll make star formations, and it looks like they're attacking each other. And when I disturb the star formation, there'll be a central ant that is like limping away. Do you know what's going on?
Well, when you see clusters of ants, it can be one of two things. Well, in fact, one of three things. Sometimes when you notice this group of ants, you'll see both winged and non-winged forms. That's usually the start of a swarm, and the workers are kind of aiding these kings and queens that are dispersing. You will find, though, that colonies will have an issue with an adjacent colony. And that may be, if you saw what appears to be ants coming from two different directions in the middle, you basically were witnessing an ant war. And I'm not quite sure why there was just one individual, because usually a number of them can be injured in these altercations.
There were more than one, really.
Okay, yeah. So those are ants that literally were injured because of what they were fighting. And, of course, ants are very chemically sensitive, and that's how they recognize what colony you're from. There's different odors associated with these. The other thing, though, I've seen with, the most common ant I see in the summer that's on pavement and in what is a European species that literally is called a pavement ant. And it's kind of fascinating to me because it's a relatively newcomer. It basically last 15 years, it's become well-established in the state. And I've noticed at times you just walk out one day and there's just a cluster 4 or 5 inches in diameter of all these ants. And I literally think they're moving. Pavement ants will move colonies from one point to the next. And as I look, they're carrying young and brood and eggs and everything else. And so it looks like they're looking for better habitation in those cases. So any one of the three are possibilities. And the general shapes can be every direction. But typically it's more a roundish or oval type shape. As I said, 4, 6, 8 inches in diameter would be the size of a large colony as far as activity on the surface.
Yep.
Do we know how the European ants got here?
Well, it turns out that probably, I'm guessing, about 15% of what we consider Wisconsin insects are not native to begin with. The pavement ant probably was brought over 150 to 200 years ago. And the population slowly moved from out east. Again, when I first started my career, I knew it was the number one pest ant in Cleveland, but I rarely saw it. And as I said, it's only been the last 15 years that it's turned out to be probably the second most common ant that's causing problems in the home that people send me. And so it definitely has become better established and, you know, just transported in flower pots and all kinds of places. It's, you know, not hard for them to move around. And again, they do well in our climate.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Rebecca, appreciate your call. Victor in West Allis, turn to you next. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi. Hey, a couple comments. I got two questions for you here. One, you're talking about the weather. I specialize, and I put some pictures on your webpage, okay? I specialize in photographing insects, okay? And I've noticed we specialize, my wife and I specialize in the wetlands of Wisconsin. I noticed with the delay summer we had, normal flowers we'll see throughout the summer were really delayed. And even the ants were down in the wetlands. Okay, number two, in regards to your tip, I have noticed a lot of people that are so inappropriately dressed to go out in the wetlands. They got their sandals, they got their shorts, and my wife and I are really well protected. And before we get back in the car, that we noticed that even when we lift the collar up on her shirt, there's one or two ticks, and even when they get by that area, we check her hairline up back of the neck, and there we'll find one or two of them sitting there waiting for her. And people don't take seriously how dangerous these things are.
Well, you know, again, it's interesting to me. I mean, Lyme disease has got an interesting story, but the more you dig into this, the more other organisms that potentially can be tick transmitted and so I said, it just is well worth it. I had a tick sample come in the lab Monday, was found on a young girl. And so, you know, you tell people there's no snow on the ground. It is tick season in this state. And you have to, again, that's something that those of us growing up here years ago, that was not an issue. Basically, by the middle of summer, it was done. But now you have to stay prepared. But basically, when you're an outdoor person, as I said, if you never go anywhere other than your home in the mall, you're not going to see these ticks. So it's not as if you have to lose sleep all the time on it. But if you spend a lot of time walking the woods, walking in long grass, as I said, it's well worth wearing long pants, considering the tick sprays and repellents and the like, and then definitely doing the checks when you come home to make sure that, you know, the good news with all these diseases, if you remove the tick on the same day it gets on your person, you won't get sick.
So. Yeah, well, won't be a problem. Vic, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Brian in Fitchburg, turn to you next. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You guys have dedicated, Wisconsin Public Radio has dedicated a lot of discussion to the emerald ash borer, and I guess a lot of the discussion has been from the tree perspective. I'd be curious to hear Phil Pelletieri's opinion of the emerald ash borer as it moves across Wisconsin, and what are the chances that my two large, beautiful ash trees in my backyard close to my house will survive? I love the trees, but I would just as soon cut them down before they fall into my house. Even though the you know, there are methods to try to save the trees and whatnot, but they just seem expensive and futile in the end. So,
well, I don't know so much futile. So, you know, the analogy that I use with people is that if you remember what happened to our elm trees when Dutch elm disease moved in the last 30 to 40 years and how it changed the landscape, it will be very similar. Because ash is such a major component in so many areas. You know, the economics of large trees suggests that it is worth to you as a property owner and like to put up the fight. I mean, it's not as if it's inevitable that those trees will be done. It's just going to be a high maintenance issue. And, you know, realtors will tell you that some of these trees have values of the $5,000, $7,000 to your property. So that has to be taken into account when you decide, should I remove it or not? And as I said, generally speaking, the economics are trees that are substantial, important shade trees. It's worth putting up the fight because, you know, it'll take 30 to 40 years minimum to get something to replace that tree and have the same aesthetics in your property, let alone the beneficial cooling effects and all the other things that go on with these trees. So, you know, now that we have an official in Dane County, as of a little over a week ago now, we're now in the area that if you're within 15 miles, and you would be in Fitchburg, of an infested area, that you should start to take precautions on those trees. And it's going to take some time. I mean, as they continue to assess, it seems that it's still very early. So often when these infestations are found, we're 3 to 5 years into a minimum. I have not heard that kind of analysis yet from Dane County, but it sounds, at least the initial reports, that we caught this very early. So it's going to take some time to build. So do the trees have to be treated in your backyard next year? No. But the longer you wait, the more the potential for it. And you'll start to see, again, untreated trees and boulevards, trees out in the woodlots and whatnot. As this starts to gain momentum in a few years, those trees will have a lot of dieback, a lot of woodpecker damage, and you can tell that they're basically going to be lost in a year or two.
Well, they'll need to be treated every year, won't they?
Depends on the products. There are some injectables that will last 3 to 4 years.
But when do you win the war here? I mean, this seems like something that can't really be.
Yeah, well, you know what the guess would be, and this is somewhat what we said with Dutch elm disease, is the first wave goes through and you experience 70, 80, 90% mortality. But then when all those trees are gone, the beetles associated with Dutch elm disease and the disease is down at a low point, so the remaining trees often have a couple decades to recover until the next wave comes. So that's what you would expect over a time frame. But unfortunately, these are, you know, 15, 20-year cycles. At minimum, and so it will take quite some time. And as I said, it will be interesting to watch this evolve. We're not going to lose all our trees in Dane County in the next 3 years, but as I said, as it gains momentum, you're going to see more and more ash dying.
Yeah. So what do you think, do we have any idea about as to cost for a treatment?
Well, it depends on the size of the tree. It depends if you do it. There are things that you can get at the local nursery or you know, discount store to apply. It can run anywhere from $15 to a very large tree and whatnot, maybe $100 plus, especially if an arborist is putting injections in it. But if you figure, you know, $60, $70 over a three-year period of time, really bad. And you know, for bigger trees, I think it's well worth considering having professionals come in. They both have some tools and some techniques that you can't use as a homeowner. For smaller trees, as I said, my colleague Chris Williamson has some great videos on the web on how to treat your own tree and those kind of things. And so it just takes a bucket of water in a tape measure to know how much product to mix and pour it on the roots, and you're off and running.
Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, our guest. Brian, thank you so much for your call. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. If you have a question, you can email us at talk@wpr.org. Or you can post a photo and question on my Facebook page at The Larry Mehler Show. Judith Sears Poisson, our producer. I'm Larry Mehler here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Contributors to Wisconsin Public Radio include Wesley Heating and Cooling, TDS Custom Construction, and the Mead Witter Foundation. You too can help ensure the future of WPR with your business sponsorship. Find out more at wpr.org/sponsor.
Support also comes from Becca Kate's Kitchen Kids and Home in downtown Baraboo, offering gourmet cookware, specialty foods, and innovative kitchen gadgets. More information at bekahkates.com.
Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mehler here with my guest, Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, taking a look at the world of insects here in Wisconsin. Join in at 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. We did have an email from Kyla in Madison, who says, by mistake this summer, we left a window open in a little used room. This fall, we found a significant number of alive and dead wasps in the room. Soon as we realized this, we closed the window. We've used standard wasp sprays, and it does have a lot of boxes in the room. Also have some holes. What should we do, if anything?
Oh, I think it's over. You really don't have to do anything, because it isn't so much the temperature, but what happens with all of our native wasps is they starve out. They don't have any food stores. There's nothing to eat. And so I typically figure by about the 1st of November, we're home free.
Okay.
And so I really, you know, you might find a nest when you move the boxes, but as far as having any activity, and they do not come back. They don't establish in the same nest, so there's no problems for next year. So as I said, usually by the 1st of November, you can pretty well be assured that whatever wasp nest is out there is dormant.
Sue in Madison. Hi, thanks for calling.
Yes. My concern is neonicotinoids used to kill insects. And certainly there is a bumblebee die-off out west. And is this in the product that people are going to be using to save their ash trees?
So the problem out west really was a question of an illegal application. They sprayed flowering linden trees to control an aphid population, and flowering linden trees have lots of bumblebee activity. So it just, honestly, it was off-label. You cannot spray any plants in bloom because of pollination protection. Where it is less of a concern on ash is twofold. One, the application is as a systemic, not as a general spray. And it's put on the roots, and when it's translocated, I don't see how bees get any exposure to it. I mean, bees don't go to ash to pollinate. You know, it's a wind-pollinated early season type creature. If they land on the leaves, it's not a problem. My only concern with that treatment is if somebody had a flower bed underneath that ash tree and did one of these systemic drenches, then there is the potential application of this product into the flowers. Now, an interesting side effect of this chemical is it does not translocate well into reproductive tissue, so it does not go into the flowers near as readily as the leaves. For that reason, it does have labels for fruits and vegetables, believe it or not, just for that reason, because a lot of times we're harvesting that reproductive tissue and it just doesn't have the concentration. Now, that being said, it's interesting. I know the Xerxes Society has a very interesting kind of white paper on pollinators and the like. And one of the problems with this chemical use in ornamental settings is that we're using much higher rates than we do agriculturally. So that potentially gets you into trouble. But the other thing you find when you're working with pesticides and plants is that you get these interesting, I almost call them personality reactions. And so one of the papers cited azaleas, for whatever reason, when you treat with these systemics, have higher than expected concentrations of the neonicotinoids in the flowers. Now, the good news to us up in Wisconsin, I can't see any reason to put those chemicals on an azalea or a rhododendron. We just don't have those kind of insect problems. But it does go to show that it's hard to make a blanket statement about everything because each individual situation has these interesting peculiarities. So, as I said, with ash, it's not a big concern. But with other trees that are pollinated by pollinators in the middle of the summer, I think you really got to take a close look. The other side is using it as a systemic is less risky than using it as a foliar spray, where anything that lands in contact in 3 or 4 days potentially gets exposure.
I have one more question.
Okay.
I am on the pest registry list, so I get phone calls when the lawn care people are treating my neighborhood mm-hmm. that I have listed. And some of the lawn care people are using, this is throughout the summer, some chemicals that have neonicotinoids in them. I'm just really concerned about them in our environment, and I believe that the EU, European Union, has been banning them until there's further research. Can you address that issue?
Well, it's an interesting discussion, and I'll be honest with you, what I find in many of these discussions is the science is only one part of the story, and there's an awful lot of politics and other things going on. In some sense, to me, it's a gray area. You know, there's no right or wrong, per se. As I said, in certain circumstances, these chemicals, you can make the argument, have far less effects on non-target organisms than other types of chemicals that are used. With some of the honeybee problems that have been going on, it seemed to be a gross oversimplification to blame this on the neonicotinoids because they pull those out of the environment and the bees are still dying. So, you know, that's a much more complicated story than just blaming it on this one chemical. But as we talked about, there are definitely circumstances where the use of these chemicals is giving us more exposure than we want. And so, as I said, it's not as if these can be used without having the pollination concern. But, you know, some of the discussions in Europe, as I said, have more than just science-based decisions going on. And that's kind of the way I go. And as I said, if you go to a somewhat someplace like the Xerxes Society that goes in rather good detail on what we know, what we don't know, citing various papers. I think people, you know, can kind of read that and come up a little bit with their own conclusions. And as I said, from my looking at it, it's kind of gray. There are some concerns, but on the other hand, I'm not so sure that banning these chemicals completely is going to solve us much, because I see other chemicals that would be plugged in for insect control, to be honest, I feel probably have more potential to cause problems.
Oh, okay. So I thank you for calling. I want to give some others a chance to join in, and we'll turn to Ben in Grafton next. Ben, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just have a quick question about, I have a bunch of rose bushes, and they seem to collect this shiny green beetle. I don't know if that's the right.
Yeah, well, it's my first guess, it is what we call the Japanese beetle, which has been a mini plague in the state for now, depending where you're located, anywhere from 5 to maybe almost 20 years. And roses is on their top of their list, but so are raspberries, and usually shows up about the middle of late June to early July, and then it is misery at least till the 1st of September. So I would guess that's who you're having problems with.
Yeah.
Any suggestions on different treatments to rid the roses of those?
There are various products, organic and non-organic, that you can use as foliar treatments that will protect the plant for 4 to 5 days. But because they fly for 2 months, it's high maintenance. I mean, that's part of what's going on. The second part of it is that, unlike many insects where you could say you do this to your lawn or you do this in an area and treat, they'll go away. In most cases, the Japanese beetles are coming in from upwards of a half mile away, so you have no control of it. So it's a very frustrating insect to deal with. It really is. But there are things, again, you can do. You just have to realize that the roses will become even more high maintenance when that insect is in the area.
Yep.
Okay, well, thank you, guys.
Yep, thanks, Ben. And Gary in Kenosha, it's your turn. Hi, Gary.
Hello. Very quickly, how early in the season, in the spring, early summer, would a person be able to see one of these full-grown dragonflies? You know, one of the large ones, not a damselfly, but a fully grown dragonfly, because a couple of years back I saw what I thought was one in April.
Yeah, well, a couple of years back, we have a couple species that can migrate up here. And so Annex junius, the big green darner, is one that is well documented to migrate. And considering the weather patterns of 2 years ago, I had all kinds of things blow up here, even in March. And I bet you that's what you witnessed. Our native species, and Annex does breed up here, I normally wouldn't expect to start to see adult dragonflies if there is a normal year, till probably the middle of June. And then things keep building as we get later on in the summer. So said, if you see them real early, more likely it's something that came in here as an adult from down south. Whereas in the summer, more likely then you've got a local breeding. And we have a number. I don't know what the official number is. I'm guessing probably about 40 species of dragonflies in the state.
Wow.
Very good. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, Gary, for calling. You can join in, too, by the way, if you have a question or comment for Phil Pelletieri. Join us at 1-800-642-1234. Love to hear from you. Tony in Mount Horeb, thanks for calling.
Good morning.
Morning.
I saw a particular tick removal tool at the local Duluth Trading Company.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of a disc, and it had like a teardropped perforation in it.
Yeah.
It looked like a little slip under and lever off. Is that a better option than the traditional tweezers or?
Well, what it allows you to do is if you slide the tick in and pull that so that the more constricted area is around that hypostome, you get as close to the area of the skin where the tick is lodged, and then you can have a slow, steady pull. The right tweezers works rather well, too. But I think the thing with this is that you're less likely to squeeze the abdomen this way, where with the tweezers, if you don't quite get the angle right in push. And why that's a concern is that many of the organisms that the ticks transfer literally come out of their salivary glands and like, and by squeezing, you're kind of pushing stuff in. And so that's why you don't want to, again, you want to get it as grasp as close as you can to the skin and then a slow, steady tug and do the best you can. Sometimes that little thumb-like hypostome, which is the feeding apparatus, will get stuck. And I tell people there, it's like a sliver. You know, the concern is secondary infections, but nothing more serious than that. So
there you go.
It's as good a design as any, it sounds like.
Yeah, and, you know, very good for dogs and whatnot, where it's kind of hard to get good leverage, but it works for people too. And as I said, I sometimes call them a tick key. I don't think that's the proper term, but you can put it on your keychain and carry it around with you.
Yeah.
And so you've always got it handy in case you need it.
Yep. Sounds like a good Christmas present.
Yeah, there you go, Tony. Thanks a lot for calling. Just in kind of relation to that, Mike, caller Mike, wondered if dish soap applied to an attached tick would suffocate it and, you know, get rid of it.
Ticks are thick enough skin. I mean, soaps kill when they can penetrate the cuticle of the critter, and ticks are thick enough skin. I'm a little suspicious it won't. If it was more of an oil-based product where we kept it covered, that's oils work by suffocation. Although you will see some reports that the soaps kill by suffocation, they don't. What you tend to find is once they get, if they can penetrate the cuticle, they just tear apart the enzymes and the internal systems of whatever the animal is. And and so, as I said, good for soft-bodied animals, but ticks are just a little bit too armored, I think, for the soaps to be guaranteed to be effective.
Phil Pelletieri, our guest, you can join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. Love to hear from you. If you got a bug that you're wondering about or maybe a photo of an insect, you can post it up on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Or again, call us at 1-800-642-1234. Caller from Duluth wondered if there are natural approaches to combating emerald ash borer that we should be thinking about.
Well, you know, my colleague Ken Rafa and some of the DNR people have been working with a parasite that has been brought over from Europe and Asia. And honestly, the good news with their experiment so far is this thing has survived and it is breeding. Now, what this will do is slow, not control completely, but slow the spread, we think. So that was somewhat encouraging. Anything you can do to keep the plant health up will give it at least a chance. Although the unfortunate thing is our native trees dealing with our native borers, if they're happy and strong, they've got defenses. It's only when they're stressed that they lose, they get weak enough to be attacked. With emerald ash borer, you know, they'll attack healthy trees. That's the unfortunate thing. But the more stressed the tree is, the faster it dies. So that's part of what goes on. You know, hypothetically, if you remove infested trees, you're basically getting rid of insect nurseries. But the difficult part of that story is many times trees are infested for a year or more, and there's very little outward signs. So that's been one of the frustrating things about how you really don't know what's infested or not unless you're peeling bark and looking very carefully and the like. And so that strategy, although originally that was something thought of 10 years ago, we remove all the infested trees, stay ahead of it. As I said, it's just really impossible to draw the line where they are and aren't in an infestation. And because of that, sanitation helps, but by itself isn't going to be a control.
We had an interesting email from David in Dairyland, Wisconsin, southern Douglas County, who said, I live 40 miles from Superior. Prior to about 10 years ago, I definitely needed to clean my windshield, scrub it, when I returned from a trip in town. This past summer, I did not need to clean dead bugs from my windshield. What does this shortage of insects do for bird populations, and why the shortage?
Well, on the bird side, there's a couple other things I think of. I know I was talking with Dr. Stan Temple a little bit, because my concern in the southern part of the state is the black flies were bad enough that I know they caused bird mortality on things like bluebirds and the like. So that's kind of a natural effect. The other thing, he was talking about the weather, and in many cases we lost one or two broods that, you know, the cool spring, the wetness and whatnot, the birds did not have reproductive success. And then you can make the argument is food also is so delayed. I mean, it was so different, you know, where 2 years ago, things were crazy in April. It didn't really start going until June. Well, that's a two-month period of time. So one could add that as another factor that made it not a good year for the birds. And, you know, my insects will recover, the birds will recover, but it's just a disappointment. I know we talked on the show, you know, previously in the last couple months that the butterflies had a bad year, although I did see some evidence of them starting to recover. So that weather patterns did have a major impact. And again, that's why I'm so surprised that I set a record for the number of samples processed, because with all those factors involved, it just shouldn't have been, but it was.
How many samples did you process?
I'll be over 2,200 before we're done, and then about 5,000 emails and a few thousand phone calls. So, you know, as I said, I'm entertained in the summer. I'm not complaining about that part of it. But as I said, comparative-wise, it's such a contrast between last year and this year. It was surprising to see this.
Jim in Madison, your turn. Hi, Jim.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
Okay, my question is, I grow a vegetable garden every summer. I have brassica, the kale, broccoli, so on, and I get those usual green worms, whatever they are, that, you know, infest that stuff. Last summer, I noticed what appeared to be bees, but they weren't quite bees, paying a lot of attention to the kale in particular, which was heavily infested. Was I seeing something like a wasp trying to lay eggs on the green worms?
Well, it could be, but if these were big and hardy like a bee, I think you were seeing predators. And it turns out bald-faced hornet, some of the yellow jackets, and even some of the Polistes wasps will collect caterpillars
for
feeding their young. And so it's interesting. You know, years ago, my colleague Bob Jean had a student that did a project with bald-faced hornet. That's the one that makes those huge nests up in the trees. And they translocated some of these early in the season into a vegetable garden, and that's basically what they studied, is how much predation. And, boy, these things just absolutely hammered those green cabbage worms. So, yes, you definitely had a natural predation going on. The wasps that sting tend to be quite a bit smaller, and they will inject their eggs into the caterpillars. And then, although the caterpillars continue to grow, as they start to mature, they start to get off-colored, and then sometimes they'll spin. But as I said, I bet you, whether it was bald-faced or Polistes, one of those two, in this European paper wasp, which is a new invasive, if you want to call it, into the state, it is known to really concentrate on all kinds of caterpillars.
Oh.
And so, as I said, you witnessed what we would call biological control.
All righty. Go Wasps. Thank
you very much. Thanks, Jim. Thanks a lot for calling. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension Entomologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Here's a look at what's coming up this afternoon here on the Ideas Network. At 12:30 on Chapter a Day, Carl Schmidt reads from The Heart of the Antarctic by Ernest Henry Shackleton. And join us this afternoon after 1 for the Kathleen Dunn Show and a look at the life of Nelson Mandela. And later, after 3 during Central Time, Rob Ferret and Jean Purcell learn about digital competition for the plastic credit card and explore the popularity of the vegan diet. That's after 3.
We talk about issues in the news and topics that improve the quality of our lives.
The weird thing is, I was arrested not by a Capitol police officer, not by a state police officer, but by a DNR warden who looked like he wasn't old enough to shave.
I don't smoke rocks, and that's the truth.
Sometimes the most memorable toys are the ones that we didn't get.
Add your voice to the mix of lively guests with different perspectives.
The Joy Cardine Show, weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Contributors to WPR include Hooper Corporation, providing electric power and mechanical construction services to commercial, industrial, renewable energy, and utility customers nationwide. Hooper Corporation, a Wisconsin company since 1913.
Support also comes from CTM with their signature production, A Christmas Carol, December 13th through the 23rd, a Madison family tradition at Overture Center's Capitol Theater. Details and tickets at ctmtheater.org.
Great to have you along on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist. Always fun to have Phil along. Certainly look forward to your questions and comments. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Love to hear from you. Kathy and Holman, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. With regard to your last caller, I'd just like to make a comment before I ask my question. Is that okay?
Sure.
He was talking about cabbage worms, and this year I noticed on my crops that the cabbage worms were bothering, that the sparrows were taking care of them, and we have a little birdhouse right next to the garden, and they would come by, you know, a couple times a day and get right up in there and eat the cabbage worms. They were also eating Japanese beetles off some of our flowers, so they were helpful. But my question is about mason bees and garden spiders. This year I saw no mason bees and no garden spiders, where last year we had mason bees all over and we had several garden spiders in our gardens.
Yeah, I always get orb weaver garden spiders in the late summer. So I, you know, they were out there. But I, as everything, I think kind of in low numbers. Mason bees, I just think it was a terrible spring, you know, and since they get active quite early, that probably did not bode well for their populations, I would guess. But, you know, they will recover. We just need some better growing conditions per se. But, yeah, as I said, it was just very interesting to watch. I mean, one of the phenomena, again, when I'm looking at my records of the years, it was a heck of a good year for aphids early season. And, you know, what we think goes on there is that the aphid populations are breeding at lower temperatures. And so they go through four or five cycles, whereas if we talk about natural control of aphids, we need warmer weather. And so until we got into June, when the temperatures finally started to get seasonable, and then the lady beetles and the parasites, you know, the wasps and everything else kind of kicked in. And so that all did come to play. So as I said, that's the other critter I was thinking of talking about for the bug of the year is aphids, but there's always aphids out there. So as I said, I figured I'll go with something different. But that was one of the big things that I witnessed out in the landscape is that early May or June, aphid populations were extremely high. And again, I think that's weather related.
There you go. Thanks, Kathy. Janine in Green Bay. Hi, thank you for calling.
You're welcome. What about mealy moths? I don't have a problem now, but I always do. How do I avoid them coming, or what do I do?
Okay, so you have to bring Indian meal moth into your house on products. Pet food is notorious for it because there's not near as stringent of inspections and rules as far as pet food. So bird seed and doggy biscuits and then things that we have around for a long period of time. So, you know, if you've had the experience of buying a particular product, it tends to be infested. One of the things you can consider is to throw the stuff in the freezer for about 5 days, because if they were active and warm and the insects were active, that should kill them. The other thing, if you don't want to go through that, is make sure that whatever container you store these items that you have around that are susceptible for a period of time is good plastic, tight-fitting lids or screw-top jars. I mean, something that if indeed you unfortunately brought something, it stays contained. It doesn't have the opportunity to get out and infest other products, because that's typically what happens. It comes in on one thing, but before you discover it, it's in the cupboard and it's the noodles, the rice. I mean, you've got a number of products, and then you throw all the stuff out and you forgot one thing, and all of a sudden you're, you know, and so it does get quite frustrating.
I know. But,
yeah. So as I said, I think the consideration of freezing new stuff that you're suspicious of, to kind of wipe the slate clean to begin with, or for things like bird seed and the like, is you find a very good tight-fitting container and make sure that the lid stays sealed so that if indeed you did bring something in, it will not have an opportunity to get out of there.
There you go.
Real fine. Also, can they be attracted to plants, or do plants attract them? Or
no,
I've heard that. Is that true?
No. Unless it's dried flowers. It's not green living tissue. It's got to be dried stuff. So,
all right.
You know, tea. Potpourri, yeah. All that kind of stuff. It's dried leaves, and they'll do well on that.
Yep, there you go. Thanks a lot. Yeah, thanks, Janine, for calling. Appreciate it. And Thomas in Manitowoc. Whoops, we'll get to you in just a minute. First, let's go to Bev in Eau Claire. Hi, Bev. Thank you for calling.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. Say, I've been gardening on the same farm for 30-some-odd years, and this past summer I had a beetle that I've never seen before, and it attacked all of my vines, like cucumbers and gourds and pumpkins, and it was anvil-shaped and sort of gray, and there were thousands and thousands of them.
Okay, I suspect it wasn't a beetle. I wonder if they're immature squash bugs, because the host plants are right, and they look beetle-like, but if you looked at them very carefully, they would have a beak-like feeding device, because it's a sucking insect rather than the chewing mouth parts. But look up on the internet, because immature squash bugs would exactly fit that description. And we have about four species in the state. You know, they have good years and bad years. In fact, 2012 was exceptionally good for squash bugs. But that would be my guess.
All right.
And how do you get rid of them?
Well, when they're small, soapy water is good. Because they're thin enough skinned. As they get bigger, you have to take a little bit more aggressive approach with products. You know, there are various insecticides that have registration, even some organic products. But as I said, when you get those clusters, I'd go after them with a soap.
With a soap. Now, as they mature, do they change in their shape or size?
Yeah, the adults are more of a dark, dull brown, and they get bigger. But the immatures have this greenish, grayish cast to them. And you can see the wing covers are not fully developed. And again, you don't find the adults congregating in clusters like you do the nymphs.
Now, they didn't have wings at all.
Right, yeah. So, and you would not expect that. Wings defined an insect as an adult. So once an insect becomes an adult, it no longer grows. So as I said, the way squash bugs work is they lay a golden cluster of eggs. They're really quite artistic if you get close up with them. And then the nymphs hatch. They kind of stay together. And, as they suck the juices out, the plants often will wilt. In fact, it almost appears. I know this is scientifically not totally correct, but like they inject a toxin because what you tend to find is big numbers, the plants tend to wilt and die back like you're injecting some kind of poison into its system.
Have you ever heard of a vine beetle? I almost thought it was a stink bug. That's what it...
Yeah, well, it's related to a stink bug. It's in the same general group, whereas vine beetles, things like cucumber beetles would fit into that category, and they're quite different looking. So I said, if you do an internet search on squash bugs, I'm sure you're going to see a picture. And if it doesn't fit, then you can contact me and we can try to fish some more. But it's just classic squash bugs in both what they're attacking and how they're working.
There you go, Bev. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. I want to give Thomas in Manitowoc now a chance to join in. Thomas, hi.
Hi. I wanted to ask you, Phil, two questions, one about wood ticks and the other one about slugs. The first one with wood ticks is, if a person goes into a pool or, let's say, a hot tub, how long would you have to be in there in order for those little wood ticks to actually die, and would that even kill them?
2 days, I'm thinking. Insects and ticks have such a slow or low oxygen demand, and they have ways they literally, they don't have lungs that fill with liquid like humans do, and so it's very hard to suffocate them. To the point, as I said, I can't think you could stay in there long enough to do that.
And the other one is how cold does it have to be to kill a soft bodied animal like a slug like that? I garden with a lot of leaves and organic matter, so I'm not able to eliminate that. And usually, you always hope for a cold winter that'll knock them off. But how cold does it actually have to be for them to die?
I think the problem with the cold is that, the books always used to tell me that slugs overwinter as eggs. But my experience is you lift a rock in the spring and there's a half-grown slug smiling at you. And so what they're doing is they're crawling underneath things and they go dormant. And so I really don't expect it could ever get cold enough. If it got cold enough to kill the slugs, it would kill all our plants. And it just isn't going to happen. So, and what you're doing to help your garden with all the mulch and stuff makes it easier for the slugs. But it's more important to keep the plants happy. So, as I said, you just have to keep your guard up. And what you're going to see has the biggest influence is moisture levels. Slugs don't do well when it's dry. Slugs flourish when it's very wet.
There you go. Thanks, Thomas, for calling. He mentioned the wood ticks in the hot tub. Kurt and Poinette wondered about... or was commenting about somebody told him that if you apply a salve on top of the tick, like Vaseline, and the tick immediately will start to pull out, you wait a minute and then you can remove it whole with the tweezers, then he encapsulates it with a tape.
Right. Some work done a number of years ago at Ohio State tried a lot of what you would define as home remedies. People burn them with matches and, again, put Vaseline or oil on them. And the research showed it didn't make a difference. Now, part of what goes on is that the tick's mouth part is like your thumb, and it is barbed with these little hooks. And then in the case of the deer tick, they glue this in. So it is not a quick experience for the tick to back out. It honestly takes minutes, if not, half an hour or more to get everything in order. It's interesting. We're talking last time I was on the show, I was involved with helping skin out a couple deer. And as those carcasses cooled, the ticks were backing out. I noticed, they were reacting because they knew something wasn't right here. But even in that, we're talking somewhere in the neighborhood of 4 or 5 hours after the deer was killed. And so, as I said, by that time, the body temperature, and that's what I think the ticks were reacting to, but definitely not a quick process. And so what the Ohio State people had kind of suggested is that we're always potentially risking infection when we do add anything to the situation. So again, it's grab, slow, steady pull, and pull it out is really what they found to be the best way to approach it.
Let's turn to Jim in Amherst next. Jim, hi. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it.
Hi. Good morning. Thank you. Do yellow jackets build above-ground nests similar to the ball-faced hornets, or are they strictly ground nesters?
Both. What we would call yellow jackets, and it turns out the ball-faced hornet is in the same group as what we call yellow jackets. There's about seven or eight species, and some are cavity nesters, so that's in the ground or in the siding of your house or in your attic, and some we call aerial nests, and those are the ones that are the big exposed. So it can be both, and honestly, they look very similar. It's just the difference in the banding, yellow banding on the abdomen and whatnot, that we can tell the species apart. But it's technically correct that you can have both above ground and in ground species, and they'll be different. As I said, the particular species have their nesting preferences.
Very good. Thank you.
Yep. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in too at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. An email from Jeff in Lone Rock. Every year during black fly season, we see a predator that we call a fly catcher bee. Really don't know what it is, but it looks like some sort of a bee with a white backside that chases flies around. They're not very efficient at it, but very dedicated to the task. What might they be?
My first thought, it might be bald-faced hornet, because they have a whitish backside. And, you know, that's one of the things. Bald-faced is more of a whitish marking and not a yellow marking like all the other yellow jackets. And they love flies. I mean, I've seen them sit on the side of a barn and pick the flies off when they go. And that was the same one, as I said, my colleague Bob Jean and his students worked with that was being a predator on cabbage worms.
And they're slow flyers. They're not a fast.
Relatively, yeah. They definitely can't chase things down like a robber fly or some of the other creatures that we've got out there. So.
Yeah. We had a Facebook question from Mary about emerald ash borer and the insecticide used to control them. This is back to the neonicotinoids. Nicotinoids.
Right.
Yeah, sorry. Is this a safe insecticide to use? I think we talked about this earlier, but what about the birds that eat the insects that are on the trees?
Okay. They're really, you know, what we would call secondary poisoning, where if you had a bunch of worms on the trees, it isn't a product that transfers that way. So I just can't see that you'd have the concentrations and the like to cause the birds any problem. Neonicotinoids are, you know, the reality, even with our organic insecticides, is a majority of our insecticides are defined as nerve poisons. You know, you find different animals have different sensitivities. The concentration is always involved. The one blessing that we kind of have, the chemicals that really had these incredibly long residuals that tended to build in the environment, and especially in bird populations, are ones that had very long half-lives where it take years for these things to degrade. That's the interesting thing is most of our chemicals now, you know, that's a red flag to EPA. If you've got a chemical that lasts a long time, the potential for it showing up in places you don't want is high. So even though you can make the argument that the acute toxicity, the short-term effect of some of our chemicals are worse than the old chemicals, they break down and don't accumulate in the environment. So that tends to be an advantage here. So again, I'm really not seeing any concern. The same concern was, you know, the concentration of the leaves fall down. Are we poisoning the worms? I mean, there's, you know, people have looked into that kind of stuff, and we don't see, you know, large builds up of those things in the ecosystem. So
that's a good thing.
Yes.
We have lots of callers online, and we'll get to you, Connie and Brian and Katie. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, our guest today. He's going to be with us right up until 12:30. We talked with him about the bug of the year, which is the Lone Star tick, and I'm sure we'll go back and talk a little bit more about that. I know we're going to talk about chiggers and mosquitoes, talk about wasp prevention. We can talk about moths and butterflies. And a little bit about bee venom. Is bee venom worse now than it was years ago? That's another question that we'll be taking up. What about you? Join in at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Back with Phil right after this look at the news.
The Madison Choral Project presents a concert titled A Light in the Darkness on Saturday, December 21st at 7 p.m. at the First Congregational Church in Madison.
The concert features holiday and secular music, spoken word, plus a premiere performance of a new work by composer David Evan Thomas. WPR is proud to support choral music performance. For more information, visit WPR.org/events.
Support for WPR comes from our sustaining members. When you set up an ongoing monthly gift, your generosity benefits everyone who listens to WPR. If you're not currently a sustainer, become one. Go to WPR.org and click donate.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. Lawmakers are proposing a bipartisan budget deal that would restore an estimated $63 billion in automatic spending cuts and eliminate the threat of another government shutdown. The increased spending in the deal would be offset by spending reductions and higher fees elsewhere in the budget. Republican Representative Paul Ryan is praising the newly reached agreement.
We've got to find a way to make this divided government work. We think it's in our nation's interest to do that. That's why we sought to reach a budget agreement that maintained our core principles and found common ground. And we have found common ground with our colleagues on the other side of the aisle over in the Senate.
President Obama is calling the deal a good first step. Ukrainian riot police withdrew from a protest camp after moving against demonstrators overnight in their latest attempt to reclaim the streets after weeks of protests against President Viktor Yanukovych. Top U.S. diplomat for Europe, Victoria Nuland, and her European counterpart both arrived yesterday expecting to negotiate for a peaceful settlement. NPR's Corey Flintoff says it's hard to say what will happen next.
And so it came as a shock to everyone that when the government decided to bring in riot troops and try to forcibly clear the square. In fact, that generated a very angry message from the United States. Secretary of State John Kerry said that the United States is disgusted by the Ukrainian government's decision to use force.
NPR's Corey Flintoff. Pope Francis has been named Time Magazine's Person of the Year. NPR's Dave Mattingly reports the award recognizes the person believed to have had the greatest effect on the world in 2013.
Time Magazine's managing editor Nancy Gibbs says Pope Francis is being honored for shifting the message of the Catholic Church away from what she calls theological police work.
So much of what he has done in this brief 9 months in office has really changed the tone that is coming out of the Vatican. He is saying, we're about the healing mission of the Church.
Gibbs speaking on NBC's Today Show. In a statement, the Vatican says the Pope isn't looking to become famous or to receive awards, but the statement adds, if it helps spread the message of God's love for everyone, the Pope is happy about that. Dave Mattingly, NPR News.
Long lines of South Africans and some world leaders are filing past the casket containing the body of Nelson Mandela today in the country's capital. The former South African president is lying in state in the amphitheater where he was sworn in 19 years ago. There will be two more days of public viewings. Mandela will be buried on Sunday. At last check on Wall Street, the Dow was down 92 points, the Nasdaq down 41. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Pajamagram Company, offering matching holiday pajamas for the whole family, including dogs and cats, at pajamagram.com.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News. I'm Terry Bell. A panel of Wisconsin state lawmakers says Common Core academic standards should not be scrapped. Instead, the special committee set up to review Common Core in Wisconsin is calling for a process for ongoing review and adoption of standards that involves legislative control and public input. The English and math standards were adopted in 2010 by Department of Public Instruction Secretary Tony Evers. The voluntary standards are in place in 45 states and are viewed by Evers and many in the education community as setting more rigorous standards for students to meet. The federal government says 7,200 people in Wisconsin have bought health insurance on healthcare.gov as of Monday. 5,300 Wisconsinites signed up by the end of November. That means 1,900 enrolled the first 9 days of December. 700,000 people in Wisconsin are expected to buy coverage from the federal government's exchange. The healthcare.gov website has been plagued with technical problems since it went live the 1st of October. The federal government says many glitches on the website have been eliminated. Ripon's historic downtown area is expected to be closed for most of the day, while three retail buildings continue to smolder from an early morning fire. Three two-story brick buildings with four businesses and five apartments were damaged. Everyone was evacuated safely. It happened on Watson Street, just a couple of blocks from the Ripon College campus. Our weather today, it's going to be mostly sunny and very cold, with afternoon highs from around 5 below zero in the Superior area to the teens above in much of the south. There's a slight chance of snow tonight, with lows in the single digits and teens below zero. This is Wisconsin Public Radio News. I'm Terry Bell.
Contributors to Wisconsin Public Radio include Northeast Wisconsin Technical College, Wisconsin Union Theater, and Rutabaga. You too can help ensure the future of WPR with your business sponsorship. Find out more at wpr.org/sponsor.
Support also comes from Madison Gas and Electric, working to meet the growing energy needs of our community through a mix of resources while helping customers protect the environment through conservation. Energy topics are available at mge.com.
No matter what the season, there are always a lot of insects around us, and whether we're talking about mosquitoes or moths or box elder bugs or millipedes, it's always fascinating and fun to talk about. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. UW Extension entomologist Phil Pelletieri, our guide to the world of insects. He helps us figure out what we're dealing with and what to do. And Phil, always great to have you with us.
Nice to be here.
We have lots of callers online. Let me give you the number. It's 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. I'd love to hear from you. We've had lots of comments about ticks over the course of the program. John emailed and said he uses tea tree oil, just dabs it on the tick. They let it go a couple minutes and flick it off with a fingernail.
Yep. One would expect that wood ticks would be easier to dislodge than deer ticks just because the way their mouth is constructed. It's a shorter thumb, per se, and they don't glue it in. So, I mean, there are some effects there. Again, the artifact of how long the tick was on your person will somewhat influence things. But as I said, I go back to the study at Ohio State that could not find anything scientifically that validated any treatments.
Let's turn to Katie and Stoddard next. Katie, hi, thank you for calling.
Hey there, thanks. I had a question. I like collecting and researching insects and everything, and I found when I collect moths and butterflies, and I've had them for a little while or let a moth go at night when it's ready to go back out, they'll sit there and vibrate, and their wings will flutter just ever so slightly, but the whole body will just vibrate for a really long time.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they take off and sometimes they don't. And I don't know if that's death throes or warming up or what.
No, I think it's warming up. You know, much like when we shiver, it generates heat. Insects being cold-blooded, their whole system is tied into air temperature. And so they have to kind of warm up the engines, might be a way of thinking of it. So normally we associate the shuddering with muscle contractions, which is generating heat, which will get to a certain point, and then they're capable of taking off.
There you go.
Okay.
Thanks, Katie. Appreciate the call. And on to Connie in Portage. Hi, Connie.
Hi, Larry. And you too, Phil. I enjoy your show. I have a question about bees. Is the venom any stronger now than it was? I'm in my 70s, and I've been stung in 20s, 30s, and by different bees. This was yellow jacket, I guess. And
mm-hmm.
I wondered because I was in pain for probably 11 hours with my hand in ice.
Sure.
And I wondered, is it stronger now?
Well, yellow jackets in general are a more painful sting than a honeybee or a bumblebee. And one of the interesting dynamics, again, for those of us who are, I'm not that much younger than you, is that the German yellow jacket, which is the number one stinging creature that most of us bump into. There's ones that you can't eat outdoors in certain years because they think anything that's sugar or protein is there. Moved into the state back in the 70s, the number of stings that people receive can go up as much as fivefold in a given year versus normal.
I mean, wow.
It's just because all this close people association and associated with, you know, kind of things you like to do in the day. So I think that might be the difference. When, you know, when I was a kid and we'd get stung by a honeybee because we were foolish enough to catch it by our hands, you know, it hurts, but the amount of swelling and the discomfort is nowhere near as bad as yellow jackets. And as I said, we know that the German yellow jacket, because of its close association with people, is notorious for a late summer problem in most years, although it was relatively quiet last year. In fact, it's been relatively quiet the last 4 or 5 years compared to what I experienced back in the 80s and 90s.
Very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling, Connie. Appreciate it. I want to go to our Facebook page because that we have the coolest photo. Man, if you can get to my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, you're going to see the coolest picture of an insect.
The best mosquito vacuum there is. So that's a dragonfly. And I'm pretty sure that it is the green diner, Anax junius, which is really the biggest dragonfly we get. This is the one we talked about earlier that does migrate up here in years, although it can breed in ponds and the like. And you notice how visual they are. They have these great big compound eyes, which they use. They catch little gnats and mosquitoes. And so, as I said, I think they deserve a lot better press than the purple martins as far as eating mosquitoes. But unfortunately, they don't get as much good press. But very good at picking up gnats. And you'll watch them. They'll rest. And when little gnats go by, off they go. And they basically chase them down. And small flies, too. So.
And this photo, it's so close that it almost looks like they're metal, you know, like aluminum head or something.
If you really look at many of the dragonflies, they're just amazing color patterns. It looks like this one was resting on a screen and, again, was kind of preoccupied. So it was nice enough to allow the person to get close to take a nice close-up. But, you know, it's just it's fascinating now with all these cameras, the kind of pictures that, you know, we've talked about on the show. That one of the main changes in my career is that now 60% of what I process in the lab are digital images that people send me. And it's just amazing the quality. I mean, I could make 20 different calendars every year from the nice pictures that people send me.
Brian in Baldwin. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So we get like these wasps that build their little hives up in the eaves of the house every year. And I was wondering if there's some kind of treatment that could be put up ahead of time to prevent them.
Yeah, not that I have a lot of faith in, other than, you know, the wildlife people at times use a very fine screening or mesh, bird netting, to keep birds from nesting in areas. And if you had a fine enough mesh, I could see you could drape it over and basically deny them access. I mean, so I've thought about that in some circumstances, but chemically, you know, if you were to use insecticides to try to kill the queens when they first come in, you know, the chemicals last for a couple of weeks, but then they break down and then a new queen can come and start. So I think it would give people, you know, a false sense that they've stopped the problem when they really didn't. So as I said, that's why I think about the physical ways of going about doing that.
Okay, yeah. They actually build their hives, like, even not even just in the eaves, but actually on the underside of the porch and everything, too. So I'm not sure if the physical area would be possible.
Well, you know,
one
of the things that has changed in the last few years for us is that this European paper wasp, Polistes dominulus, that has moved in, is notorious for making its nests, and they're small, usually about 3 or 4 inches in diameter, behind things. You know, the old native Polistes usually made this little nest that you could see on your overhangs, and they were pretty obvious. This one is you know, behind shutters, behind doors, you know. And for that reason, I think people have more of a risk of getting stung, because you're often working and you bump into something having no idea there's a nest there. And all of a sudden, they take great offense of you being present. And so I've noticed in the last 3 or 4 years when they've showed up in my yard, as I said, we got to be careful about the sundial we hang on the wall and everything else we put out there.
Yeah.
Because they often get up underneath things, and just like you said, underneath the porch would be a place.
So does a queen come pretty quickly? Is she there, like, as soon as you see the nest garden being built?
Yes.
She's there right away?
Yes.
So if you got rid of it right away,
That would work. But the other thing that I've witnessed with this European species is that normally you'd think the nesting season is May and early June to start nests. I swear I've seen Polistes, the European species, establish nests in the middle of August. So they can go very late. And so it is a changing dynamic with that species being in an area.
There you go.
I don't know if it's gotten, I don't think it's gotten up to Baldwin yet. You know, it's been more the southeast part of the state that I've seen the activity, but it's coming.
There you go, Brian. Thanks a lot for calling. It's a kind of a fascinating email from Dave. At my former bird banding station, we trained bald-faced hornets to take dead houseflies after we observed them pouncing on a black magic marker X on a white piece of paper. Interestingly, after they picked up a dead fly, they'd land, always upside down, either in the banding station or on a little jack pine outside the door. They'd chew the wings off and then fly off with the body.
Yeah. Well, you know, the wings are non-digestible. There's no muscle there, so that sounds very efficient. And, you know, again, going to back to my colleague Bob Jean with his students, they did a lot of studying of various yellow jacket species. And one of the things you find with yellow jackets is not as sophisticated as honeybees, but they can communicate a food source, and they almost become habituated to it.
Oh.
One of the reasons this was studied is we were trying to find baits. And you could find that you could have something that would normally be very attractive, but you had a colony that was homed in at taking, you know, meat scraps from a garbage can. You couldn't stop them, even though you'd put something that they supposedly like better right in front of the nest. As I said, they get habituated. So the same thing, if you train them to go after the house flies, it would make a lot of sense. They just keep coming back because they know it's a place that they can get a good food source.
Bruce in Green Bay has a question. Bruce, hi. Thanks for calling.
How are you doing?
Good.
I was wondering if laundry dryer sheets will keep mosquitoes away, and what's the best way to get chiggers out of your system?
Okay.
Out of your skin.
So I have experienced the laundry bounce dryer sheets are the control for everything that's wrong in society. I'll tell you from the science point, nobody has ever come up with any data to suggest that they work. Even though I know it's a common home remedy for a lot of things, keeping mice out and the like, and so I just really can't speak to it. But I don't personally see how they would work against mosquitoes. The problem with chiggers is not that the chigger is still in your person. Often the chigger has been gone for a day or more after you start to react and get those incredibly itchy wounds that last for a long time. And so, there really isn't. You can prevent chiggers by using some of the tick sprays and the like. Technically speaking, if you're out in an area with chiggers, you come in, you take a real quick shower and dry off. You could technically dislodge a number of them before they get a chance to crawl in. But by the time you see the reaction around your belt line and the like, as I said, they're long gone, but your body's reacting to all the debris that they left behind. And so really it is an allergic reaction.
Every time I think about chiggers, I think back to a time when I was in the jungles of Nicaragua a long time ago and wound up with a chigger infestation all around my ankles. And it was the most awful experience.
It's, you know, in general, you think of chiggers being more tropical, you know, and so that's something you run into. We do have them here if you get in the right environments in Wisconsin. And again, interesting enough, not all of us react. I know my wife has had some real nasty reactions to chigger bites, and I have been with her, you know, picnicking in the same place and had none at all. So I don't think they like Italians is my take, but that's, we'll see.
Oh, man. Cindy and Eau Claire, it is your turn. Hi, Cindy.
Hello. Thank you for having this show. Help. I'm living in Eau Claire, and maybe I don't know a lot of people, but I'll bet one in four people have had some form of tick-borne disease.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not counting their animals. We're just being besieged by them up here. And I was wondering, you said there was an under-reporting of the disease.
Well, you know, so what CDC came out and talked about is that, you know, to have an official report that goes in the state mm-hmm. record has a number of things that have to follow. And what they find is a lot of physicians, you know, we've got it here. Why even do the paperwork? So a lot of cases they were treating without doing the paperwork. And as I said, as CDC looked into it, figured that the average is that 10% of whatever the numbers are, the official numbers, really we have 90% more cases in a given state. So that's why I said you would expect 30,000 cases of Lyme. We also have anaplasmosis, ariculosis, Powassian virus. And as I said, now a new species of Borrelia that has not been discovered or not published on yet, but appears that is tick-borne. So, there's a lot of things to be concerned about.
Well, I wanted to know, since it is perhaps, you know, I realize more paperwork for physicians, et cetera, but is there something that we can actually do, pressure somebody or just pressure our physician or call in or bother the CDC or whatever to get more research done on this, because it's getting to, well, it's scary to go out in the woods in the summer up here. And
well, there's a lot of research done, but to be honest, you know, when people call me and say, I've got a 200 acre, you know, property and we love to walk and the like, there is really very little other than your personal protection you can do that's going to influence the tick populations. You know, we know there's some good stuff. University of Connecticut's got a great thing. You know, they've got a lot of Lyme disease out there, talking about things you can do in your backyard to make it less tick prone. But it's really kind of simple. I mean, you keep your lawn mowed, you keep the long grass. But where you get the risk is when you're going off in the woods and crawling around. And as I said, I just don't know anything that is practical in those circumstances that is going to give you any kind of long-term control. We do know that treating your clothing properly and the like is really extremely effective at preventing the ticks from getting access. So, you know, the permethrin clothing sprays, some of them will last for weeks with a single application. You can even buy special clothing where you can go through multiple washings and it works. And the whole part of that technology is that if the tick walks on treated fabric, it will die well before it gets the chance to transmit. So as I said, those are the kind of personal things that people can do to protect themselves against this.
Would you mind going through a few more of those just simple, you say, common sense preventative things that we can do? And also the new, describe what some of the new diseases are. And when you say microorganisms that are they passed on by the Lone Star tick?
Well, the Lone Star has some organisms associated with it, but our big player in this state is the deer tick. It is just so much more efficient. And what all these turn out to be other than that Powassian virus are rodent diseases. Hmm. And when the tick feeds on an infected rodent, it becomes infected. And then, you know, our deer tick feeds three times during its life. So its first feeding, it's clean. After that, it potentially can transmit to the next animal it feeds on. And so that's what we find throughout the United States. The more we study this, we're finding more and more rodent diseases becoming people diseases because this tick is the bridge. And so that's the part. And as I said, the more we study it, and these are not the easiest things medically to study. And that's one of the reasons as people start to look, we are surprised, but maybe not surprised, that we're finding other organisms that are closely related but aren't quite the same or a new organism. But the dynamic in Wisconsin is that the number of deer ticks and where they're found in the state has increased dramatically in the last 30 years. The infectivity level of Lyme disease alone now averages about 40% in the adult ticks. It was not that high back 15, 20 years ago. So it has gained momentum, and that it explains if you look at the records of Lyme disease cases, the official records, even that has been on a constant increase in the last 20 years. And so, as I said, it all kind of makes sense when you look at it. And that's why we have to do a lot of public education to get people aware of it. The good news, the medical community is far more attuned to this than they were, you know, when this was new for all of us. But, you know, one of the concerns is we don't have all the blood tests for all these organisms that are efficient enough now to really tell. So, as I said, it gets to the point that but if you know you had a tick bite and you start experiencing fevers, rashes, body aches and the like, you got to talk to the family physician, because the good news about all these things, if you treat them early, we have very good success. Where you hear about the tragic stories is if these are not treated early, there is the potential for all kinds of complications down the road.
Yep. There we go. Thank you very much for calling, Cindy. Appreciate your call. We had an interesting photo, as a matter of fact. Can you confirm that this is a female Dobson fly?
Yes, I can.
An interesting photo on my Facebook page here.
You know, it's very well camouflaged because of the setting. The reason I can tell the gender is that male Dobson flies have these incredibly long mandibles that stick out, look very, very scary. And although you can see the mandibles on this, if you look close enough at the front end, they're quite short. So that's how we know it's a female. You find them in nice rivers, good clean water. That's what Dobson flies need to breed. Short-lived as adult, very prehistoric-looking animals, but really kind of neat. But they're big. You know, one of the bigger critters you'll find in this state.
Pretty cool picture. We have, you know, there was a kind of a fascinating story not too long ago I wanted to bring up about the black widow spiders in grapes. Do you know that story?
Well, see, I see it all the time. You know, when I get a black widow sent in the lab or somebody sends me a picture, my first question is, were you buying produce, and in particular from out west, and in particular grapes? Because in my career, I have seen this probably a dozen times or more. And, you know, typically when people find them, you know, grapes kept cold and whatnot, the spiders aren't moving. So I've never run into a case where somebody's been bit. But on more than one occasion, in the last one, I had a sample come in within the last month. Somebody had organic grapes from California. And as I said, that's what we expect. That's the Western widow. We do have a Northern widow species here. Unless you go looking for it, you will not find it. It's a very secretive spider and the like. And so, as I said, I don't, other than people I know that are biologists looking purposely for them, find out that people are finding black widows in nature in Wisconsin.
Wayne in Appleton, thanks for calling. Hello.
Hello, Larry, and hello, Phil. Appreciate your program. I have noticed a dramatic decline in the monarch populations, for sure this summer. And for the last several years, I've been growing, you know, plants that attract monarchs, purple coneflowers, butterfly weed, and the broadleaf milkweed. The problem that I'm seeing is that a lot of the broadleaf milkweed is overrun by ants. Now, I understand that there's a symbiotic relationship between ants and aphids, and if you can keep the aphids off, it won't attract the ants. It appears to me that the ants are actually, you know, also possibly, you know, taking the monarch larvae.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that's what's happening? And if so, what can I do to keep the ants
mitigate
off
that?
The
yeah.
Well, you know, there's a lot of things. Monarchs have. It's surprising we see any of them by the time you figure earwigs and Asian lady beetles and ground beetles and all kinds of things will feed on them, especially when they're small. If you're trying to get a higher success rate, to be honest, it's well worth when you find the first larvae is bring them in the house and rear them, you know, keep all the parasites and predators away from it. Then you'll find, and then you release them when they come out. And it's, you know, if you got kids around, it's a great, great project for them to observe and watch what's going on. It's going to be a little hard to keep the ants off. I mean, you can go out there with soapy water and spray, and it will kill the aphids. I would be a little careful. You know, a big caterpillar could care less about the soap, but a very tiny one. So you got to be selective where you spray. But what you tend to find is the aphids are congregating on the stems, and, of course, the caterpillars on the leaves. And so I think if you could try to keep the aphid numbers down, that would keep the ant numbers down and maybe give you a chance. But, again, if you're serious about trying to get better success, is grow some plants indoors in pots, bring the larvae in when you find them in, and again, keep them protected that way. And then instead of having like a 1 or 2% success rate, you might be lucky and have like a 40 or 50% success rate in getting the larvae maturing.
There we go. Thank you very much, Wayne. And Phil, thank you so much. Wow. Lots of calls today. It was
for a cold day, the bugs are pretty active.
And we can still do this in January, can't we?
Oh, yes.
I think so. Phil Politeri, UW Extension Entomologist, our guest. He'll be back in next year, and we'll do it all over again. Patty Nagai joins me tomorrow, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Racine County, for our next edition of Garden Talk. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.
This is Mike Crane, Director of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'll be hosting a 5-day Wisconsin Public Radio-sponsored trip to New York City, April 10th to the 14th. This getaway weekend features a live performance of Garrison Keillor's A Prairie Home Companion. The cost of this journey, guided by Holiday Vacations, includes airfare from locations throughout Wisconsin and accommodations in the heart of Times Square. More information is available at wpr.org/travel.
Support for WPR comes from EdVest, Wisconsin's college savings plan. EdVest encourages Wisconsin families to consider the importance of saving for higher education in a tax-smart way. Information is available at edvest.com or on Facebook and Twitter. Support also comes from Sprint Print, serving Dane County businesses since 1987, with full-service printing, including large-format signs, banners, and more. Details and information at sprintprint.com.